How would you like a night where we deal only with mermaids, werewolves, vampires, and other strange creatures? Well, you get that night tonight on Coast to Coast. Varla Ventura with us, and she's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Author Varla Ventura is a lover of all strange things that are freaky and terrifying. She's the curator of the Wiser Magical Creatures and Paranormal Parlor series of ebooks. Lives in a very creaky, haunted attic of a Victorian in San Francisco, which is kind of creepy all by itself. Varla, welcome back. Are you still up in that attic?
Oh, thank you, George. It's great to be back. Actually, I just recently left San Francisco after, I won't even tell you how long I lived there, nearly my whole life. And I now live near the Twin Cities in St. Paul.
Oh, I love it. I lived there for a year. It's just a gorgeous area.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, thank you for saying that. It's been quite a transition from the gritty urban to the wild forest.
Yeah, people are great. Weather is cold. It's going to get cold in the winter, but it's refreshing.
Yes, I suppose I'll just have to write in the winter. And
That's right, exactly. Yeah, I wanted to thank you, too, for the Beyond Belief TV show we did. I mean, I had fun doing that.
Oh, that was so much fun, and I don't think I've talked to you since then. That was wonderful. I hope that people are watching that show and subscribing. It was really a lot of fun and a beautiful, beautiful area in Boulder. It was fun to be there.
Oh, my gosh, sure is. So I love creepy stories, and you obviously do, too. So you got to tell me, how did you get started in all of this?
You know, I think I was just sort of born into it to a certain extent. You know, my mother's always been very influential in my life, and she, as mothers are, and she was a dabbler in the occult, but she was interested in the occult and metaphysics and ghosts and sort of, you know, the other realm, not in a devout and heavily religious way, but just in a open-minded, kind of curious way. And so there were all kinds of strange books on her shelf when I was a child. And it's interesting because I have many sisters, and we all have, although we are all very different, we have a similar feeling toward things of the unknown and the other world. And, you know, picnics in cemeteries were very common for us. That was a way that we spent time together as a family, actually. So, you know, that kind of thing kind of influenced me, and I was always sort of encouraged to, you know, talk about, you know, did I have some kind of, I mean, my mother taught me lucid dreaming when I was like 3 years old, which is a good time to teach because, you know, you're very open to that kind of thing.
Sure.
So, you know, we had an old grave on our property, which we sort of discovered, and then we tried to talk to, it was a little girl, and I was a little girl, so we tried to talk to her on the Ouija board, and I know that to some people that might sound scary or negative in some way, but it never was. It was always, you know, in fact, we used the Ouija board during the day most frequently. We didn't all sit in a circle, you know, in a basement surrounded by candles at night, although that sounds fun too, now that I'm grown up.
You've collected a lot of strange stories and facts and factoids about all this, haven't you?
I have, and sort of the first book that I wrote along these lines, The Book of the Bizarre, was sort of born out of just, I kind of always noticed, you know, I grew up reading all the Ripley's Believe It or Nots and just kind of encyclopedia of the strange and books like that, all the Hans Holzer that was in my grandmother's basement and things along those lines. And I was like at a party one time saying some random fact about a, you know, weird law in Oklahoma that you can't whistle underwater or something. And this friend of mine just said, you really should start putting these things together. And I approached Wiser Books. I had a friend that was an editor there, and I approached her, and they really liked the idea. So we ran with it, And there was so much left over, we kind of immediately knew there was going to be a second book. And then that sort of segued into the whole Weird Creatures. And I'm actually working on, you know, another book for them right now. So
what are you going to call it?
You know, I probably would get in a lot of trouble if I said what I want to call it. So for now, we'll just call it Varla Ventura's World of Strange Fairies. But that kind of just sums up what it is. It's another book that kind of goes where banshees, werewolves, and vampires went, but we're going, and Among the Mermaids, but we're going more into the world of pukas, changelings, you know, bog hags.
What's a puka?
A puka could be your best friend or could be your worst nightmare. Puka is a shape-shifting creature from the fairy world, usually appears as a rabbit or a horse. Those are the two most common ways that you will see or encounter or read about a puka. You may actually, occasionally there are stories in Ireland of them, you know, being some kind of bird or crow or something like that. But most often they are rabbits, or in the case of like Harvey, he was a giant 6-foot rabbit. And what they do is they sort of appear and they just kind of shake things up. So my theory is they appear at a time in your life when you really, really need to see them, because they're tricksters. And they sort of take you to, it's like that friend that takes you on that ride that terrifies you, and you scream the whole way down and you have some sort of epiphany, and then you get to the bottom and you think, that's what I should be doing, or that's what I shouldn't be doing. And with pukas, so often, especially in Irish folklore, they're tied in with the town drunk. So the town drunk.
The poor town drunk.
You know, it's the one who's stumbling along the roadway at night and says, I saw a puka on the way home. Or the puka kind of is like, you know, what are you doing? They appear and you think, I'm drunk, so this cannot possibly be real. No one believes them the next day. And even if they're not drunk at the time, no one believes them the next day. And that's sort of the whole, in Harvey, I don't know if you remember, the play that was then turned into a
book. But the rabbit, sure thing, the invisible rabbit.
Jimmy Stewart, exactly. And so no one believes that poor Elwood P. Dowd, right? No one believes him. You see Harvey right here.
He's right here, he's big.
You don't see this guy I'm talking to. And after a while, you know, he just kind of gives up and he's just talking and doesn't care if people believe him. And so the puka sort of exists to, like, challenge your way of thinking, I think, and kind of get you back on track. And so that's often, you know, most often the puka will appear. Sometimes it's a horse, and in the puka legends actually even sort of morph into the headless horseman legends, because pukas are sometimes seen as ferocious black horses with like fiery eyes, and they will have occasionally there'll be stories with, you know, a headless rider. And then there's a death carriage that rides through the hills with, you know, these fierce black horses. So they do kind of tie in with some of the other creepy legends.
Let's talk a little bit of werewolves and some of the stories you've accumulated over the years, Varla. What are some of your favorite werewolf stories?
I think, you know, actually, I think you have a guest coming up who is an expert on the Bray Road werewolves in Wisconsin. Some of those sort of more modern accounts of werewolf stories.
You're good, by the way. You know our guests and everything. That's Linda Godfrey.
Linda Godfrey. I love her. And I think I was, she was on another show that I was on just a couple or a week ago, really. And I believe it was the same topic of, she wasn't talking about it, but it came up and I said, this woman who knows all about the werewolf of Bray Road, because there's only so many people who know that much. So some of those modern day accounts, those can, as you know, in your line of work, those can sometimes be the more terrifying stories, because you have a tendency, you can read about these, like, you know, this medieval rash of, you know, murders, or some woman murders her husband in a desperate rage, and then they come the next day, and she says, well, I think I turned into a werewolf. You know, it's like leading, you know, guilty by reason of insanity, or not guilty by reason of insanity. Those kinds of things you can kind of put in context. It can be harder to put in context, you know, the average Joe walking along or driving along the road and seeing something and then finding out that, you know, 10 other people have seen the same thing. But I think for me, the thing that is kind of the scariest about the werewolves are, and keep in mind, I do say scariest in a good way.
Is there scary in a good way?
Well, I mean, if you
maybe during Halloween, late at
night, yeah, if you don't like to sleep, and you stay up late listening to Coast to Coast every night, you probably like scary to a certain extent.
A friend of mine works at a hotel chain here in the St. Louis area, and she says, I love listening to you. I hate listening to you. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, every time I'm in the car and I'm going home, it's late, I'm listening to you, and you're talking about someone's in the back seat of your car and that you could see them in the rear view mirror. I hate that. And she says, I've got to pull over and look and everything else. But people really get affected. And that leads me to, of course, what you're talking about, scary stuff. But go ahead. Go back to your werewolf.
Oh, I was just going to say along those lines, I remember as a very young woman driving along, listening to Coast with Art Bell, actually,
yeah,
and taking the late night drive back to, at the time I lived in Portland, Oregon. And I would leave and I would just barrel through, you know, you're 21, you can do anything, and you're cruising along and you're just listening, you know, and I would always get, would be coming from the Bay Area. And right around the time that I would get to that real desolate stretch of Highway 5, and it's, you know, 2 a.m. and it's nothing but me and a couple of truckers, that's the night he's talking about, you know, roadside UFO abductions in Oregon. And you're just like, oh, no.
And you're waiting for one to come scoop you up.
Well, you're not going to fall asleep at the wheel, I'll tell you that.
That's true. That's why we keep people awake.
But I think for werewolves, one of the things that I think is both interesting and terrifying.
And by the way, you wrote a book about that called The Natural Causes of Lycanthropy, which is humans turning into these kinds of animals, right?
Yes, yes. And a lot of that is based on the work of two people. Elliot O'Donnell, who people may recognize if you're a fan of ghost stories. He was a collector of ghost stories and werewolf lore, not so much vampires, but kind of things of that nature back in the late 1800s and in Ireland. Another was a man, he was English by birth and I guess he was a pastor, or he was a man of the cloth. And his name was Sabine Baring Gould, and he wrote Onward Christian Soldiers, if you remember that.
I remember that. Basket. Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, he also wrote the most extensive and most complete volume of work on the study of werewolves to date. And it's a largely unknown work. I stumbled upon it myself when I was working on this Magical Creatures collection for Wiser Books a couple of years ago, and became kind of fascinated with the fact that not only did he do all of this research, and he traveled all over the Nordic countries, and so he traveled, you know, promoting Christianity at the same time he was collecting stories. And from, it's a very thick book, I would say, you know, in print it would probably be 500 to 600 pages. And it was, and it's dry and a little bit confusing because it was written in 1865, and, you know, there's a lot of language in there that you might not enjoy reading. But underneath that and within that are endless stories of natural causes of lycanthropy, supernatural causes. accounts of people turning to werewolves, accounts of people being cured from being a werewolf by eating a specific plant. And a lot of his research was in the Nordic countries. And I think, you know, he even talks about the sort of berserkers in the who are these fierce Norse warriors who would basically go berserk. That's where we get the term berserk. They would just work themselves up into this crazy frenzy. And it's believed that they would take some sort of plant or drink some kind of concoction that would just get them like really fired up. And then they would go into battle just like insane, and they would cover themselves in fur, and they would just like go crazy, and you would of course be terrified if you saw
like an adrenaline rush, but worse. Huh?
Exactly. And then, you know, of course it's, you know, all sort of like a super warrior of danger.
Well, these werewolves, Varla, I mean, are they people that physically change, or do they look like wolves because maybe they're genetically, you know, a mutation? What are they?
Well, what's interesting is that one of the conclusions that Sabine Baring-Gould came to is that we all have the propensity to become werewolves, and that human nature, because we have, many of us, you know, been furious enough to see red or have that moment of that adrenaline rush, that moment of like pure just anger or ferociousness, we therefore have the capacity to transform. And he talks about, you know, serial killers and how serial killers kind of can't switch that off, and that there's a certain, you know, personality type that's more likely to morph into a werewolf. On top of that, there are, you know, numerous reasons. It might be, you know, a person with a lot of hair. It might be, you know, there are actually like physiological reasons that someone might appear like a werewolf. There's also shapeshifters, and there's, you know, a lot of things are lost in translation when you have this, for example, this man who's traveling around promoting Christianity, and he's just taking his point of view of these stories that people are telling him, and he's putting them down. And so when you're reading these things, you have to take that into account, that this isn't a non-biased approach. This is somebody who, you know, has a sort of extreme belief and is, you know, transposing that on maybe, you know, what the indigenous people of the area do or practice. So in many ways, on many levels, they are completely real, right down to the fact that it might just be some freaky thing that could jump out of the bushes right now.
Do they hurt people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're blamed for hurting people. You know, it's interesting because when you look at some of the more romanticized stories of werewolves, you find the enlightened werewolf is the hero to us all. The enlightened werewolf is the one that knows he transforms and he can't do anything about it, but he goes away from the village to protect the one he loves.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back and talk more about creatures with Varla Ventura on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Varla Ventura with us. We'll take calls next hour with her. And, of course, we're talking about werewolves right now. We are going to get into vampires and some other creatures, too. Strange creatures on this planet, don't you think, Varla?
They are, and among them, humans probably take center stage.
Yeah,
most of the time.
Absolutely. So back to these werewolves. These are people who turn into these strange creatures, and then they turn back again?
Well, I think people are relatively familiar with the term shape-shifting, so I'll just assume that your audience has a basic understanding of shape-shifting.
Right.
That you would, it's coast to coast, I think they do. But, you know, you go into sort of a transformative trance and become a, you know, take on the attributes of another being, usually an animal. So with werewolves and with wolves sort of having this, you know, undeniable mythology, sort of loneliness, this howling, it makes sense that people would you know, be able to tap into that kind of behavior. And, you know, on maybe on like a spiritual level, okay, we're going to transform into a werewolf voluntarily. Now, on the other hand, there are a lot of strange things growing in the forest and bubbling along in the stream back in the day, and still are. And there, what's interesting is that I find that, werewolves, along with vampires, have a very similar sort of persecution and accusation period in time, much that parallels the witch craze, especially in the, you know, like 1600s in Europe. And so most of you are accused of being a witch, but you might also be accused of being a werewolf, maybe being a vampire. Usually, you know, I think werewolves and witches were the more logical accusation. And that would be the explanation for, you know, the ripping apart of livestock. And then it's like, oh, it's the guy next door who keeps saying that he wants my land. It was totally him. He turned into a werewolf mm-hmm. overnight and he came over here. So there's that element of it. I mean, it's, you know, it's definitely not a linear sort of thing. It's not like, you know, there's one solid story that proves undeniably that a man transformed into a werewolf, or actually a woman transformed into a werewolf. There's just an overwhelming amount of evidence, both in folklore and in sort of common everyday folk seeing strange things, coupled with some scientific stuff, like, you know, the fact that people get crazy around the full moon. And people,
well, they do, big time.
They really do. I mean, I think you probably have noticed, if you do a show on the night of the full moon, you probably get the call, the real doozies calling in.
I had an emergency medical technician tell me once in St. Louis that during a full moon, they got more calls, it happened every month, more calls during that time period than any other time period in the month. He said it was uncanny that as soon as the moon got full, those calls would start. All kinds of things, you know, injuries, you know, strange things. And he said it just happens every month that way. It's weird.
Oh, and I can attest to that from living in the, you know, Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco for 30 years, that on the full moon, you think it's weird normally, on the full moon, that you couldn't sleep. I mean, even if you wanted to, you couldn't sleep. And I think that sort of ties back in with this idea that Sabine Baring Gould touched on in his book, and actually he more than touched on it, he brought it up over and over, the theme that we all have the propensity to, every one of us, and how terrifying is this, but we all have within us the possibility of becoming a ferocious beast, the possibility of becoming a werewolf, of transforming into going into a murderous rage. Every one of us probably has that one thing that just might send us over the edge. Now, whether we act on it or not is the difference between whether you become a werewolf or not, I suppose. And another thing he said, which is probably why this book is not currently in print, and that is that he talks about, it's often tied, werewolves and that transformation is tied historically with some of the, with puberty and sort of like turning into a teenager. Well, it's also tied in with pregnancy. And, you know, there have been all kinds of, there's still crazy stories about, you know, pregnant women are, you know, they rocks and they, you know, crave strange things. And it definitely has this hormonal influence. Well, he talks about how pregnant women are more likely and very similar to werewolves, which I don't think would be a very popular theory today, and probably why his book is not, you know, on every shelf in Barnes & Noble right now. But he has a point, and I think the point is well taken, that, you know, we all do have that sort of lingering madness just at the end of our regular thought process. And therefore, we all have the ability to go over the edge. Hopefully, we won't push anyone over the edge tonight. But
what are banshees?
Now, banshees are another terrifying creature, and they fall more in the realm of fairies. And they're very interesting because they actually sort of straddle the world of fairies and the world of ghosts. And banshees are typically the sort of a mourning spirit. A mourning and a warning spirit. They warn of death or illness in your family. You can actually inherit a banshee. So if your family for years has seen a banshee appear right before someone in your family dies or takes ill, you will continue to see that banshee. Almost always, actually, I will say always, and if anybody thinks otherwise, they are welcome to call in and talk to us about it. But always women, thought widely to be believed to be women who died in childbirth or lost a child, lost a baby, and then died of a broken heart. So they have this sort of like wild, mournful cry, which is very scary to hear in the night. And you never see them during the day. These are not day creatures. And they themselves are not totally evil or out to get you, but they are warning ghosts. And the thing that is so scary about them is that while they themselves cannot do anything to you, except maybe break a few dishes and, knock a few pictures off the wall, they are there to let you know that, death is nigh. So that's kind of scary because, most people don't have their, affairs in order enough to be able to see a banshee and then know how to react. You're just probably going to go cowering in the corner and hope it goes away.
Are these creatures, are they big, small? How big are they?
Well, like a banshee, I think, is probably woman-sized. So, that's a wide range.
Well, there's a lot of tall women out there.
And they can, there are many accounts, as with other supernatural creatures, of them taking on a great size. You open the door and all of a sudden there's a, 10-foot tall kind of, gnarly, gnashing teeth beast outside your door. They very often look either like a very, a little old lady sort of hobbling down the road that you then tap on the shoulder and say, "Oh, may I carry your basket?" And then she turns around and it's like this crazy thing and you realize what you've done. It's a beautiful woman, or it sounds like some sort of beautiful woman in distress, and so you go out into the night seeking it. And that's sort of their secret. I mean, that's how they get their message across. Not unlike mermaids, actually. That sound and that song can kind of lure you out into the dark of night.
Why do people want to be scared?
Well, I mean, there's amusement parks dedicated to it. There's something about that sort of, the thump of your heart that gets you, wide awake and gets your adrenaline going. I don't know if people really know that they want to be scared. I mean, there's plenty of people who say they don't like scary movies. They don't like cemeteries. They don't want to open their door in the middle of the night. But I think it's natural that if you love something, you want to protect it. And so generally your worst fear is that something's going to happen to it. It could be yourself. It could be your beautiful stereo. It could be your child. There are many things that, we kind of naturally want to protect. And so because what are we going to protect them from? We're going to protect them from this sort of unknown. So maybe that's why people, they need to be scared in order to stay on their guard. I personally just really am sort of addicted to it.
What scares you, Varla?
What scares me? Dying a pauper and no one buys my books. That's what really scares me. That would be kind of worst case scenario.
Well, that's not going to happen.
But I think like everyone, you know, something happening to someone that I love dearly. You know, it's interesting because I think there's something that happens and why many of these accounts are in the dark of night. It's not always like 2 a.m. or midnight, but often, you know, we call midnight the witching hour. And there's something about this period of time, and I find that I write the best at this, at, you know, these late hours of night. There's something about the sort of veil between this world and the next that's just a little thinner, that's just a little, it's a little more open to possibility. And maybe it's that it's quiet otherwise and everybody's sleeping. But I do think that there's something sort of afoot in the dark of the night that, you know, creativity can be tapped into. In other words, our minds go, you know, down all manner of roads at 2 a.m. and, you know, we can't sleep, or we, you know, just we are out for a walk because it's a beautiful dark night and we want to get away from people.
Who are some of your favorite writers of scary stories? Was it Poe? Who else?
Yes, I love Edgar Allan Poe. You know, probably one of my favorite horror
King.
Stories.
I like King, Stephen King, too. He's, you know, his stories always had that strange ending.
And the thing about Stephen King is that he has the amazing ability. Has he ever been a guest on your show?
I can't get him. He won't do radio. We've tried.
If you're listening.
One day. Break down, Stephen. You're in, yeah, probably lives in L.A. I don't know where he lives.
No, he lives in Maine.
He's way out there, huh?
Wonderful.
Well, he could be on the phone.
Reclusive. Exactly. You know, he doesn't have to show up in person. We just want to talk to you. He's amazing. And his real strength is kind of along the lines of what I was talking about. He really taps into the everyday fears, and then he makes them real. So there you are alone in the, you know, alongside the road, and you pull off into this seemingly harmless rest stop, and, you know, someone attacks you. You know, it's just like these sort of things that terrify you. He doesn't stick only to the supernatural, but he's not afraid to use some supernatural tools to really scare you. But I love Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper.
Ah.
And I mean, there's something about the way that she is sort of cloistered into this room, supposed to, you know, it's that typical story of like this woman who's kind of, you know, I think she has like hormonal issues or whatever, and so she's sort of, you know, sequestered off, and her, oh, well, let's just take her out to the country air and she'll feel better. You know, she's a little unbalanced. And they put this unbalanced woman alone in this house with this like mad wallpaper and sort of leave her locked in this room. And it's her own mind that sort of does her in. And I think those kind of stories, and that story in particular, you know, I find those extra scary.
You stayed in an abandoned boys' reformatory some time ago, didn't you?
Yes, actually, that was a fun overnight with my mom. And
why did you do that?
Well, you know, it was my sister. My sister Dina said, "Hey guys, does anyone want to stay overnight in Preston Castle?" Somehow she had heard about, you know, she's a big fan of
it's
the
haunted,
paranormal.
Isn't it?
It's supposed to be one of the most haunted places in all of California. And what it is in the during the Depression era, it became it's this beautiful giant brick stone mansion. And the third floor is completely, the fourth floor is unfinished. So you can actually, when you arrive, there are bats flitting about the rafters. I mean, it was like totally Harry Potter. It's just like completely freaky when you know, because of course they have big, for tours like that, you arrive at dusk. And my sister just said, "Hey, I heard about this place, and actually if you do this overnight, all the money goes to the restoration of Preston Castle." And it goes, you know, it's all docent-led, it's all volunteer, so not all my sisters, but two of my sisters were on board, and my mom, of course, was like, "Hell yeah, I want to stay overnight." I'm on it. In a haunted reformatory. So it was a place where during the Depression era, we found this out when we were there, during the Depression era, people who had boys, it was boys, I think, as young as 7 and as old as 18, who they couldn't feed, it was a place that they could bring them. So it was sort of like, you know, a foster home for them. And some of those boys were never picked up again.
Oh,
you know, I don't know if you can imagine abandoning your child, but, you know, you've got maybe 6 kids and you know there's a place where one child can regularly get a meal. I can see the rationale. So when they came in and they were dunked in this pool to rid them of lice or, you know, sort of sanitize them. And so, you know, the pool is in the lower level and it's this just sort of shallow, deep pool, which of course is completely empty. There's not a lot of things scarier than an empty pool. I mean, you know, it's like totally poltergeist. And you just sort of go through this, the room by room, floor by floor, led by a docent who knows everything about the history, and they give you plenty of time to sit. They bring an EVP recorder and talk to people about what their experiences are, and the docents are the ones who are there every single day, day in and night. So they have like the really authentic, amazing experiences. And we did. We stayed the night. We did not sleep. You are allowed to just like bring a sleeping bag and lay it down in the room, but we could not bring ourselves to actually fall asleep or even stop moving, exploring the entire place. And so you basically go from like dusk till dawn in this castle. And my sister had her hair pulled.
And she could truly feel that too.
Yeah, she was across the room from me and she just like froze. And I asked her what happened and she said, "Something just pulled my hair." I didn't have any physical like poking or prodding or anything like that. But I did snap a photo in the very beginning. And it was right at the time when we were sort of all sitting down and doing an intro. And the woman who was leading our group told us about this little boy that she had become acquainted with there. He was about 10 years old. I think his name was William. And she started calling him. She said, "William, William, come on in." And we're just sitting, and we had all the lights off. Like, "William, would you like to come and say hello?" And I, you know, you could sort of snap photos at, I know, right? Just snap photos at random. And I did, and of course you don't look at the photos. And the next day I looked at the photos, and the tons and tons of orbs.
All over the place. All over the place. Barlow, stay with us. We're going to come back, talk more, and take some phone calls. Plus, folks, share with us your scary stories.